It's time to get organized this new year with Menards. Update your closet system and add style today with Closet Culture. Choose from two closet finishes and four colors of shelf boards to create a functional yet stylish closet solution that matches your home decor. Check out all our Closet Culture closet kits or view our weekly flyer on Menards.com to see all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hey, y'all. I'm Carrie.
I'm Momo.
And this is Monstrous. This episode contains topics and language that may not be suitable for all listeners, and topics that may be triggering to some. Listener discretion is advised. But we are back for another episode. Mama is back at this one, which might be a good thing because Mandy's going to hate this one when she goes back and listens to it.
Why?
Because she hates clowns.
Well, I ain't real fond of them.
Like, she cannot stand clowns. Yeah, so she's not going to like this one. So I have a lineup of episodes for this time of year, like I said in the last episode, but this one is an exception. We are going to head way back to the 40s and to the summertime, which is really nice right now because it's 30 degrees.
It's spitting snow.
Yep. So I will take...
Ninth day of November.
Right. I will take some summertime. Okay, so Mandy, like I said, whenever you listen to this, you're going to hate this one. I'm sorry.
We love you, Mandy.
Yes. Okay, so this is a true crime episode, but it is a true crime of negligence and disaster on a horrific scale.
Like a couple of my marriages. And
oh my God. You're too much.
We're you love me.
Two
know.
Minutes in. Calm down over there.
See what happens when you take me out of the house.
So today we are covering the Hartford Circus Fire of 1944. So we are going to bridge the gap between the List family murders and next week's episode with a tragedy that terrorized a community and permanently changed fire safety laws across the entire country. Yeah. Okay. So imagine taking your child to the happiest place on earth.
We're going to Disneyland.
Only for it to become a flaming death trap in under 10 minutes.
Oh, my.
This single event claimed the lives of 167 people.
Oh.
And injured over 700 more.
Oh.
With the vast majority of victims being mothers and small children.
Oh, now that rips my heart out.
So the date is Thursday, July 6th, 1944. We're in Hartford, Connecticut, in the middle of a hot, humid summer. But more importantly, we're in the middle of World War II. The home front was a place of stress, questioning casualty lists and worry. For the American people, any moment of genuine distraction and joy was a precious thing. In 1944, Hartford was a city of contrasts. The war touched every home. Families hung service flags in their windows, ration books were tucked beside grocery lists, and news of fallen soldiers arrived daily by telegram. But on that July afternoon, the circus was a brief reprieve from all of it. Families traded the sound of air raid drills for the laughter of clowns and the sparkle of sequins. Even the posters for the circus had a kind of defiance about them. Bright reds and blues, elephants in parades, a reminder that joy could still exist in the middle of a dark decade. And there was no bigger joy than the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus, the greatest show on earth.
I've been to the Barnum and Bailey Circus.
I've never been to a circus.
Well, that's because by the time you were born, honey, they were no longer around.
They still have them, but they're far and few between. And
they're not Barnum and Bailey. There's some odd.
They don't have animals anymore.
No, because of animal cruelty laws. Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of them were treating animals awful.
Yes.
It's like, I get...
You know, it amazed me because they treat those animals so awful. And a lot of those animals could eat you.
Right.
I mean, I'd want to say, here, kitty, kitty, kitty. Uh-uh.
Like, the elephants could just step on you.
Or smack you with their trunk.
You know what I mean? But the sad thing is that a lot of them were gotten as, like, babies, like cubs.
Yeah.
And so they had never known anything different. It was just awful. Ugh. Anyway. So the music of the brass band filled the tent, bouncing off the canvas walls like sunlight on water. The laughter of children rose above the rhythmic stomp of elephants and the metallic clatter of acrobatic rigging. Everywhere you looked, there was motion. Lions pacing in their cages, candy vendors shouting over the crowd, the glint of sequins catching the light as trapeze artists waited their turn. For just a moment, it felt like the world outside the big top didn't exist. Beyond those tent walls, there was war, rationing, telegrams that brought news no family wanted to read. But under that big top, people were allowed to forget, if only for one afternoon. The circus was set up on the Barber Street Fairgrounds. The afternoon matinee meant the massive crowd, estimated to be between 6 and 8,000 people.
I believe it.
For the matinee. That's crazy. So this was overwhelmingly composed of mothers, grandmothers, and small children. Their fathers and husbands were mostly fighting overseas, and this was their day of reprieve from that. The whole show was a magnificent spectacle designed to make you forget all about the war, especially the famous, dizzying act of the legendary Flying Wallendoss, whose high wire performance was one of the main draws that afternoon. There's no way that I would be that high above the ground on a thin-ass wire.
Don't look at me. I don't even like getting on the step stool.
Right. Like, I'm not terrified of heights, but I'm not the biggest fan of them. Like, no. There's no way.
Like I said, I don't even like to get on the step stool.
Net or no net, you will not ever catch me up there. So, more power to you.
My hat's off.
Exactly. So, the air was thick with the smells of sawdust, popcorn, and exotic animals. But under the hot July
elephant
sun...
Elephant poop.
I cannot with you. But under the hot July sun, the heat inside the massive canvas big top was oppressive. It was a giant, humid oven that afternoon, making the audience uncomfortable and just a little bit distracted. But lurking above and below them was a set of financial and logistic decisions that had already sealed thousands of fates. The tent itself, so the big top, right, was enormous. So I'm going to try to paint you a picture. It was large enough to cover 3 full city blocks.
Dang.
So it was huge. That afternoon, it was packed with thousands of people who had nowhere to go but up and out. Due to wartime shortages, the circus management had made a catastrophic criminal choice to be cheap. The proper fire-resistant chemicals needed for treating a tent of that size were scarce, often reserved exclusively for military use during the war. So, instead of using proper fire-resistant material, the Ringling Brothers management decided to waterproof the canvas with a makeshift coating. And that coating, you ask, what was it made of? A highly combustible mixture of paraffin wax and either gasoline or kerosene.
Oh, Jesus Louise.
Yep. Mm-hmm. It's waterproof, all right.
It's waterproof, but it ain't fireproof.
Right. Essentially, They took a 3-block long canvas structure, filled it with thousands of people, and turned it into a massive, highly flammable wick. The officials who ran this show had actually been explicitly warned by fire safety authorities in other cities that this paraffin gasoline blend was dangerously flammable.
Yeah.
But the Ringling brothers were used to getting their way. Investigations later showed that the circus management was accustomed to operating without a prior fire permit in town after town, relying on small bribes to local officials to overlook obvious fire code violations, including their toxic tent and dangerously blocked exits. The circus's operational negligence was staggering. Their fire extinguishers were either empty, buried under equipment, or simply inaccessible. They were lacking nearly half of the required exit capacities. Much of the reserved seating consisted of loose folding chairs that were not secured, a built-in tripping hazard, and damningly, the management had also neglected to secure proper access to a reliable pressured water source, meaning even the nearest city fire hydrants were effectively useless. Crucially, there was also no working public address system, ensuring that when disaster struck, the ringmaster would have no way to issue calm, unified evacuation instructions to the thousands of people inside.
What a bunch of dum-dums.
Yep. So this wasn't just poor luck. It was a systematic chain of criminal negligence fueled by greed and arrogance.
That's usually what it is.
And on that hot afternoon in 1944, that negligence was about to ignite. So the date is July 6, 1944, approximately 2:40 p.m. Inside the Big Top, the matinee performance is in full swing. The eyes of the crowd, those thousands of mothers, grandmothers, and children, are fixed high above them, mesmerized by the dizzying spectacle of the flying Wallendas, I think that's how you say that, sailing through the air without a net. The distraction is...
Without a net?
Yes.
Oh, hell no.
Right. So their distraction is total. Not paying attention to anything else. The crowd was still. Eyes fixed high above the ring. The Wallendas moved like dancers through the air, 1 foot, 1 heartbeat, 1 breath at a time. 1,000 people held their breath as if any sound might break the spell. The smell of sawdust hung in the air, and the only sound was the creak of the tightrope and the slow exhale of awe. For one fragile moment, it was perfect. That rare kind of silence right before everything shatters. And that is when the fire began. It didn't start in the center ring with a burst of pyrotechnics. It began innocuously as a small flickering flame. It was on the southwest side wall of the massive tent, near a partition that screened the men's toilet area. One mother sitting near the exit later said she saw the flame before she understood what it was. A thin orange tongue licking upward, so small she thought that it was part of the act. A roustabout saw it too, sprinted toward it with a bucket, but the air itself seemed to catch fire before he could reach it. In the band pit, a trumpeter dropped his instrument when he felt a sudden rush of heat sweep down from above. Not warmth, but a blast that felt alive, like the breath of something monstrous. Initially, it was small enough that a worker might have been able to stamp it out. Several roustabouts, the circus staff responsible for setup, saw the flame. But rather than immediately hitting the emergency call box or shouting a general warning, there was a fatal delay. The circus culture prized quiet efficiency, and these workers believed they could handle the problem themselves. They ran for the empty or buried fire extinguishers. This momentary delay, this hesitation to alert the thousands of people above them, would be the most consequential 2 minutes of the entire day. The flame wasn't stopped. It quickly grabbed hold of the supporting rope that ran straight up toward the roof. Once it reached the top, the fate of the thousands below it was sealed. When that small flame touched the canvas, it ignited instantly.
Oh, heck yeah.
So, remember that?
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Waterproofing coating? The paraffin wax mixed with gasoline and kerosene?
Yeah, that was a time bomb waiting to happen.
Well, it didn't just burn. It turned the entire structure into a colossal sheet of fire.
I believe it.
The canvas was no longer a covering. It was a gigantic horizontal fuse. The fire shot across the big top like a massive sheet of flames. Within seconds, the heat intensified to an unbearable degree, and the big top was shrouded in thick black smoke. At first, no one screamed. Some people even clapped. They thought the orange flicker was part of the act. A few seconds later, though, the applause faltered. Someone shouted, "Fire!" But it was swallowed by the brass band. A man stood up to look, blocking the view of the row behind him. A mother reached for her daughter's hand, and then, as if a switch had flipped, chaos. The tent roared. The air itself changed like it had come alive and wanted them gone. The shift was immediate. Down on the ground, the circus van, led by the veteran Merlee Evans, saw the terrifying flash overhead. Evans didn't need a formal announcement. He knew the big top was gone. Instantly, he signaled the band to drop whatever patriotic piece that they were playing and switch to the Stars and Stripes Forever Disaster March. This was the chilling prearranged code among circus personnel, a shift in tempo that meant absolute emergency. Begin evacuation procedures now. The brass band's music suddenly became a desperate, urgent soundtrack to the panic. However, only the seasoned circus hands understood that signal. To the thousands of civilians, mothers, and children looking up, it sounded like just another dramatic piece of music, a flourish for the Wallandas act. They were still watching the acrobats, still waiting for the cue to leave, unaware that the ceiling was collapsing around them. As the canvas ignited, the physical horror began. The intense heat instantly began to melt the paraffin wax mixture. Molten, flaming wax rained down onto the thousands of people below.
Oh my gosh.
Coating hair, clothing, and bare skin, igniting on contact. People weren't just fleeing flames. They were fleeing burning liquid that poured down from the sky above them. The distraction turned into confusion, and confusion instantly snapped into mass panic. Screams replaced the music. The crowd surged into a desperate, horrifying stampede towards the exits. The victims faced a triple threat: the flames, the heat, and the smoke. The black, acrid smoke from the burning mixture filled the big top, stealing breath and visibility. People were literally running blind. Witnesses later described the fire as moving faster than thought. One second it was a flicker, and the next it was everywhere. People remembered the heat first. One survivor said it felt like the air itself was on fire. That breathing was like swallowing flames.
Oh, I can imagine.
Right. A father who escaped through a slit in the tent said he turned back and saw a mother on her knees, shielding her child beneath her body, refusing to move. Like, how either circus continued to go on after this, it just blows my mind. We'll get there, but it just blows my mind. Mm-hmm. A young boy would later say that the screams never stopped, that when he closed his eyes, he could still hear them echoing throughout the years. Even the firefighters, hardened men who had seen war, said the sounds of it stayed with them for the rest of their lives.
Oh, I bet.
Now, this is where the criminal negligence became a logistical slaughter. The entire crowd, estimated nearly 7,000, but somewhere between 6 and 8, funneled toward the main entrances, which were the most familiar points of exit. but the Ringling Brothers had failed to provide sufficient exits and illegally blocked the ones that exited. So the entrances were like a one-way, and they blocked the exit. Which,
and that's why they are no longer in business.
Yeah. Key evacuation routes were not only inadequate, but they were fatally obstructed. Steel railings designed to contain animals blocked the main passages, causing people to climb over them and creating fatal pileups. Furthermore, other exits were blocked by massive animal cages and chutes that had been positioned for the next act. These steel barriers transformed potential exit routes to lethal dead ends. The unsecured seating, so those loose folding chairs, became another obstacle. Thousands of chairs were overturned in the stampede, creating a literal carpet of tripping hazards that people stumbled over because it's pitch black. They can't see. Many victims were crushed, not by the fire, but by the relentless, desperate crowd behind. A significant number of the dead were children, killed by trampling in the stampede as their mothers desperately tried to pull them through the crush. Yet, amidst the terror, there were heroes. In several places, quick-thinking fathers and military men used knives, their belts, or whatever they could find to slash the side of the walls of the heavy canvas. They tore huge gashes into the sides of the Big Top, creating instant, unplanned escape routes that allowed hundreds of people to pour out onto the fairgrounds. The field outside the tent was a storm of motion. Firemen carried limp children out through holes in the canvas. Soldiers ripped up shirts to use as bandages. A teenage boy ran back into the smoke 3 times before someone stopped him. Everyone there would tell their story differently later on, but they all said the same thing. It happened too fast. The speed was unbelievable. In under 10 minutes, the entire Big Top, a structure that covered 3 city blocks, was completely consumed. The support ropes, poles, and guy wires that held up the 19-ton structure were no match for the heat. The intensity of the flames fueled by the paraffin and gasoline was so extreme that even the heavy central steel support poles were bent and twisted into grotesque shapes. They didn't just fall. They melted and crumbled.
Mm.
The terrifying final event, the entire structure began to collapse. The Big Top, still burning fiercely, came crashing down. Hundreds were burned beneath the flaming, heavy wreckage of the canvas poles and bleachers. Inside that massive searing mound, all life was extinguished. So anyone still left inside was gone once the Big Top came down. Local Hartford fire and police rushed to the scene, but nothing could have prepared them for the scale of the devastation. They arrived to find not a building on fire, but an incinerated field covered in screaming injured people and a smoldering, unrecognizable ruin. Which I have pictures, and I'll show you.
Well, I don't need pictures. My mind's doing it for me.
It's so much worse than what you could imagine. It's awful. Which those will be on Facebook for everyone listening. What remained was a field of smoldering ash, the scent of burned canvas and popcorn, and a desperate rising silence. This was the deadliest disaster in Connecticut history, and it was finally over. So sometimes it's the silence afterward that haunts you the most. The moment the crowd's noises fade, and all that's left is the echo. The sound of what should have been laughter was silence. The fire burned out in 10 minutes, but for Hartford, time stopped there. And for every parent, every survivor, every rescuer who stood in that field, those moments have lasted a lifetime. And when the last of the flames were out, Hartford was silent. Smoke drifted above the fairgrounds like a ghost that refused to leave. What remained was a flat, wet, smoky field of debris. The inferno was over in under 10 minutes. The heat was so intense, it had sterilized the ground where the tent had collapsed. What remained was a scene of unbelievable carnage. Twisted metal, charred wood, and the scattered, grotesque shapes beneath the smoldering canvas. In the immediate aftermath, there was no order, only desperation. Survivors wandered the field, dazed, burned, and calling out names. Fathers, alerted by radio reports, sped back from factories and jobs, tearing through police lines, clawing at the wreckage, frantically searching for their families. The emotional core of the scene quickly became symbolized by one devastating photograph. This iconic image showed Emmett Kelly, the famous clown known for his sad sack persona, surveying the wreckage. His painted frown, usually a source of comedy, was now a genuine expression of profound, genuine grief. A picture later referenced as the day the clowns cried. Hospitals across Hartford were instantly overwhelmed. Nurses worked barefoot on soaked floors because melted wax clung to their shoes. The city's morgue ran out of space within hours. The scale of the disaster quickly forced officials to implement a macabre process. With so many casualties and so many of them burned beyond recognition, the city's resources were instantly overwhelmed. The Hartford Armory, a massive drill hall-style building, was quickly converted into a temporary morgue. Because the disaster occurred during the peak of World War II, the military had to step in immediately, deploying soldiers to act as guards and clerks and handling the process using military-style protocols due to the sheer volume of the dead. This was so overwhelming that on July 7, 1944, Connecticut Governor Raymond E. Baldwin had to issue a special executive proclamation declaring the dead to be victims of a war-related catastrophe, allowing state emergency powers to be mobilized for recovery and identification.
I would not want that job.
Yeah, but good does come from it. We just got to get there. We're making our way, I promise. So as the bodies were recovered from the Barber Street Fairgrounds, they were laid out row upon row. The final death toll was confirmed to be 167 lives lost. The process of identification was treacherous for both families and officials. Many victims had been killed not by the direct flames, but by the flaming molten wax, the extreme heat, or the stampede. It is estimated that nearly two-thirds of the victims, while severely burned, had actually died from asphyxiation or traumatic compression. So they were crushed and suffocated in the bottlenecked rush toward the blocked exits, a direct result of the lack of safety preparation.
Fucking stupidity.
Mm-hmm. To put it simply, the fire left bodies unrecognizable. Families had to walk those rows in the armory searching for any small detail. A piece of jewelry, a recognizable patch of clothing, or a specific dental record. Jewelers were brought in to identify pieces of melted jewelry, and dentists worked around the clock. The identification task was made even more grim because the intense heat caused the silver amalgam in many victims' teeth to vaporize, leaving the exposed teeth a sickening, recognizable black color. A specific horrifying signature of the fire. For over 100 children lost, the task was especially harrowing. The anguish of a parent having to verify their child's identity based on a button or a shoe buckle was one of the lasting psychological scars on the Hartford community. In one devastating instance, a family correctly identified their child's body only to realize the next day they had been given the wrong remains, which they had then turned around and returned.
Oh my goodness. Talk about double heartbreak.
Right. But you can kind of get how that could happen.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I understand it, but does it mean it would?
Well, no, of course not. It doesn't change, you know, what that does and how that makes you feel. But with just the chaos and just how...
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner. So you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Many people had died. You could get how that could happen because it's hard to tell who's who. So among the remains recovered, a total of six individuals would remain unidentified for decades. The last known victim to be identified and claimed was a woman identified in 1997 through dental records as Grace Dorothy Fifield, the missing Vermont woman. This left five victims officially unresolved. For those five, one is a Black adult woman, one of the few African-American victims of the fire. She was recovered wearing a gold wedding ring, yet no matching missing persons report was ever filed, leading historians to suspect her family may have been lost in the fire as well. The five victims who remain officially unresolved are still identified by the morgue tags originally assigned to them by the Hartford County Coroner in 1944. These numbered markers were their only identities for decades. The scene was compounded by the literal mountain of scorched, unclaimed personal effects. Hundreds of melted coins, broken dolls, and children's shoes that had been sorted by police, a silent testament to the number of lives lost. So the bodies that were left unidentified, they were interned in a mass funeral at Northwood Cemetery, marked simply as unknown, except for one small blonde girl, only known by her body number, 1,565. She was tiny, with soft blonde curls and delicate features. Her face, even in death, seemed peaceful, as if she were simply asleep. Reporters couldn't bear to call her by a number, so they called her the Little Angel. For decades, she remained the most haunting mystery of the Hartford fire, becoming the profound, heartbreaking symbol of innocence lost. No one knew her name, but everyone claimed her in some way. Strangers began leaving flowers by her grave, and the local community adopted her story as its own. The police investigators who found her body became privately obsessed. Sergeants Thomas Barber and Edward Lowe privately ensured she was not forgotten, placing flowers on her grave for more than 40 years. Their efforts included distributing the postmortem photograph of Little Miss 1565 nationwide, making her the most recognized unidentified victim in U.S. history at that time. Yet, despite weeks of searching and widespread publicity, no one claimed her. Her case remained cold for nearly 50 years. So for decades, her grave was a pilgrimage site. Teachers took students there on field trip. Survivors left notes they couldn't say out loud. Every July, someone would place a single white carnation on her headstone. No one ever admitted to doing it, but it never failed to appear every single year. She was estimated to be between 5 and 6 years old.
Just a baby.
She had distinct features that should have made her easy to identify. Yet, no one ever claimed her. She was buried in an anonymous plot in a Hartford cemetery, becoming the profound, heartbreaking symbol for the entire tragedy. Why had no one come for her? Was her entire family lost in the fire? For years, investigators and researchers kept her file open. It was a cold case that lasted, like I said, nearly 50 years, haunting the community and the investigators that were dedicated to this fire. The eventual conclusion, though, came in 1991. Through advancements in forensic technology and the persistent efforts of dedicated historians, Little Miss 1565 was finally identified as Eleanor Emily Cook from Southampton, Massachusetts. However, this identification remained controversial for more decades, as Eleanor's own mother, Mildred Cook, had viewed the body in 1944 and insisted until her death that the child was not her daughter, Eleanor. The controversy still persists today because Eleanor Cook, who was 8, was described as having 8 permanent teeth and was wearing a plaid play suit. However, the body of Little Miss, 1565, was found to be closer to the age of 6 with only 2 permanent teeth and wearing a flowered dress. So for decades, another theory had also persisted that the girl was actually 4-year-old Sarah Graham, who also vanished that day. Even recent efforts in the 21st century, including excavation of some of the identified bodies from mitochondrial DNA analysis. But these have yielded inconclusive results thus far. Forensic scientists discovered that the high bacterial content of the soil where they were buried and the extreme heat damage rendered the samples too degraded for definitive genetic comparison, leaving the original case files as the primary yet imperfect source of truth. On July 10, 1944, the still unidentified victims were buried in a mass funeral at Northwood Cemetery, paid for by the state, while Little Miss, 1565, received a distinctive small headstone bearing only her tag number. The others were interred in graves marked simply as unknown. The case was presumed relentlessly for decades by police investigators. Sergeant Thomas Barber, who found the child's body, and his partner, Sergeant Edward Lowe, became so obsessed with the little angel that they privately ensured she was not forgotten, placing flowers on her grave every July 6th, Christmas, and Memorial Day for more than 40 years, a tradition that local groups continue to this very day. Now, the fire itself had been spotted around 2:40 p.m. on the canvas near the main entrance, which was the south end of the Big Top, specifically near the entryway to the Wild Animal Chute. This location immediately implicated circus staff negligence. The horror of the fire was so complete that it even scared the circus performers themselves. So Emmett Kelly, who I mentioned earlier, the famous Wary Willie clown, used a bucket of water to try to extinguish the flames. But he later admitted the images of burning people and the cries of the children had haunted him.
Oh, I bet it did.
Mm-hmm. So obviously there was a huge investigation, right?
Oh, yeah.
Trying to identify those that had been injured, those that had been killed. So that was the main focus. But the investigation quickly turned to accountability. The physical evidence, so the dangerously flammable canvas, the blocked exits, the lack of equipment, was impossible to ignore. Ringling Brothers executives were swiftly charged with negligence and involuntary manslaughter for knowingly cutting costs by using the lethal flammable mixture and by prioritizing profits over public safety by blocking those exits. As we can all imagine, the anger in Hartford was unlike anything the country had ever seen. Families didn't just mourn, they demanded justice.
And I don't blame them.
Right. Editorials across the U.S. called the circus a, quote, a traveling death trap. Politicians who'd ignored fire codes for years suddenly couldn't run from reporters fast enough. In a rare show of unity, unions, civic groups, and ordinary citizens pushed through reform after reform. The law had moved because the people refused to let it stand still. Facing overwhelming evidence and public fury, 6 Ringling Brother officials eventually pled no contest. So that means that they're saying, oh, okay, there's enough to be found guilty, but I'm not admitting to anything.
Right.
Yeah. Some places it's called an Alford plea.
Nolo contendere?
Yeah.
Did I say that right?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I'm impressed.
Mm-hmm. So they were convicted and several of them served prison sentences ranging anywhere from 6 months to 7 years. Before eventually receiving pardons.
Mm-hmm. I don't think they should have gotten pardoned.
Yep. Yep. Kind of takes you by surprise, that one. So this was an incredibly rare moment of accountability for a major American corporation in a disaster case. Crucially, the circus was forced to create an unprecedented victims compensation fund. Because over 1,000 lawsuits were filed, the disaster was so immense that it forced the creation of a special arbitration board to hear and process all the claims outside of judicial jury trials. Ultimately, the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus paid out approximately $5 million in settlements to the victims and their families. This settlement, the matter of the structural negligence, the reason the fire had spread so quickly. However, even after the corporate convictions, investigators were unable to definitively determine what actually started the small spark on the sidewall, leaving the official cause of the initial blaze undetermined.
Well, I mean, it could have been somebody smoking a cigarette and flicked an ash.
Right.
I mean, something that innocent.
Mm-hmm. But they just weren't able to figure it out ever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this left a lingering question. And 6 years later, a separate, darker question would emerge. Was the disaster not just negligent, but deliberate?
You never know. Somebody could have been pissed off at the circus.
Mm-hmm. So the legal accountability was settled. The Ringling executives had served their time, the families had received their compensation, and the city of Hartford was attempting to heal. The official narrative was clear. The death toll was due to criminal negligence and an undetermined initial spark. Then, 6 years after the fire, a shadow was cast over the entire case. So the year was 1950. Police in Ohio arrested a young circus roustabout named Robert Del Sigi on charges related to starting several small brush fires. Sigi, who had a documented history of pyromania, had worked for the Ringling Brothers Circus in 1944. Under intense interrogation, Sigi cracked. He confessed to starting the devastating Hartford fire.
Damn.
Mm-hmm. Robert Del Sigi was only a young man when police had found him, but his eyes carried the kind of weight that made you look twice. He spoke about fire the way other people speak about music, with reverence and almost love. When he confessed, his words were eerily calm. He described lighting a match, watching the tiny flame dance, and then seeing it bloom into something terrible and unstoppable. His confession was chillingly detailed. So I'm going to go into it just a little bit. Sigi claimed he entered the tent near the men's toilet, lit a cigarette, and then casually used it to ignite a piece of decoration or partition near the sidewall, the exact location where the fire had started. Adding to that psychological horror of the case, Sigi claimed he was driven to set the blaze by an apparition of an Indian riding a flaming horse. He claimed he saw the flame quickly catch the rope and shoot up toward the paraffin-coated roof, but instead of raising an alarm, he just watched the destruction before slipping out into the chaos. The confession suddenly provided the missing piece of the puzzle, the trigger for the blaze. Sigi was a classic pyromaniac, and his presence and job with the circus put him right at the scene. He also confessed to starting other less deadly circus fires in other locations that same year. But just as quickly, he denied it all. He said he'd made it up, that the visions he spoke of weren't real, and that the, quote, Indian on the flaming horse, end quote, had only existed in his mind. Mm-hmm. So, was he a killer seeking forgiveness? Or a damaged man so haunted by guilt that he took a crime he hadn't committed?
That's a tough one.
Either way, he became part of the fire's legend. The ghost in the ashes, the man who might have started it all. The police and prosecutors were facing a dilemma. They already had convictions against the corporate management for the fire spread and the resulting deaths. Sigi's confession, while detailed, was entirely reliant on his own words. They lacked...
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner. So you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Any crucial physical evidence to definitively prove that he lit that match 6 years before. Furthermore, his documented psychological issues. Ultimately, Robert Seege was tried and convicted for the unrelated fires that he set in Ohio, but he was never formally charged with the Hartford Circus fire. He spent time in a psychiatric institution and then later in prison, dying decades later without ever facing trial for the deadliest act he claimed to have ever committed.
He may have started it, but they were still negligent.
Right.
So they got what they deserved.
Yep. There was a hand by both.
Yes.
So where does that leave the question of the cause? The answer remains frustratingly unresolved.
Well, yeah, because there's no way to prove either or.
Right. Was it simply a carelessly tossed cigarette from a spectator or a worker? This was the most common theory immediately after the event. Given the extreme fire hazard posed by the tent, it would have only taken the slightest spark to ignite the tragedy.
Right.
Or was it Robert Dale Seege, the young, disturbed, roustabout who confessed and recanted, but knew details that only the fire starter would know? Many private investigators and families believe that Seege was indeed the perpetrator. Now, because the state of Connecticut never brought charges against him, and due to the lack of forensic evidence to verify his confession, the official cause of the fire remains undetermined today. The state jailed the people responsible for the negligence that killed the victims, but the person responsible for starting the entire thing was never punished.
Well, technically he was, but not for that.
Right. So despite the ambiguity surrounding the initial cause, the horrifying speed, and the immense loss of life on July 6, 1944, forced profound nationwide change. This is the single most important and positive legacy of the Hartford disaster. The Circus Fire served as a devastating wake-up call to legislators all across the United States. Almost immediately, states and municipalities adopted new rigorous safety standards for public gatherings. The key changes included drastic, permanent changes to national fire safety codes for all public tents and temporary structures. It became legally mandated that all canvas and decorative materials used in public assembly must be thoroughly treated with fire retardant chemicals. The era of the paraffin and gasoline tent was officially over. Never should have started to begin with, but...
Thank you very much.
Yes, we all live and learn, I guess. Whatever.
But unfortunately, they learned the hard way.
Yeah. Furthermore, laws were rewritten to require a specific ratio of exit capacity to the maximum crowd size, ensuring exits were clearly marked, completely unobstructed, and sufficient for rapid evacuation. The kind of lethal bottleneck seen in Hartford became illegal everywhere. Now, in the 80 years since the Hartford Circus fire, no American life has been lost due to a fire in a public tent assembly. This disaster, purchased at the cost of 167 lives, permanently raised the floor of public safety across the entire country. The Ringling brothers' name, once synonymous with wonder, became a byword for negligence. Attendance dropped sharply. It took nearly a decade for the circus to recover its reputation. And even then, the shadow of Hartford never left. Every tent that went up afterward carried a silent promise written in its fabric. This will never happen again. Now, it's worth noting that the final act of the Ringling Brothers organization itself. Now, once the immediate chaos subsided, the circus management packed up their trains and fled the jurisdiction of Connecticut, attempting to outrun the inevitable legal action. It took court orders and warrants to force them back to face the charges of involuntary manslaughter. But they didn't come up and are bad.
No, they got their butts kicked.
They tried to run. Before they could get far, though, the entire 79-car circus train was impounded by court order. So they didn't just say, you're coming with us. They took the whole damn 79-car train. Yeah.
You go, guys.
Right. So the spectator rail cars were legally seized, standing on a rail, citing as a massive, immobile symbol of the legal battle that then followed. So it just sat there. Could you imagine seeing that? A circus train just chilling there?
It's like, hey, dude.
Now, to prevent hundreds of pending lawsuits from bankrupting the company outright, the circus voluntarily placed itself into a state of friendly receivership. This unprecedented legal maneuver allowed the court to seize control of the circus's assets and future profits. The court-appointed receiver then ran the circus for the next decade, with every performance and ticket sale being funneled directly into the victim compensation fund.
Good.
The show literally went on to pay for its mistakes for a decade.
Good.
The circus also faced 551 injury claims and 169 death claims. So through an unprecedented arbitration process, Ringling Brothers ultimately paid out, like I said, nearly $5 million in total settlements, which is over $87 million today.
Mm-hmm.
So a key element in the final insufficient financial settlement was the statutory cap in place at the time. So Connecticut law placed a $15,000 ceiling on death awards, a fact that was a point of deep contention.
They only got $15,000 for their death of their loved ones?
A piece, yep.
That's sad.
So this unique legal...
Of course, you can't put a price on that either.
Right, but that, even that, it's like, really? So this unique legal resolution is formally referred to in case law as the, quote, creative settlement of a mass disaster. This provides a blueprint for handling liability in future catastrophes. So the final payments to the last victims and their attorneys were not finally issued until 1954, meaning that some of the families had to endure a 10-year financial and legal purgatory.
Yeah.
So, like I said, all six of the Ringling Brothers officials were eventually granted pardons after serving less than 2 years in prison. Yeah. So they were given sentences anywhere from 6 to 7 years, but served less than two of those.
Mm-hmm.
So the official reason given for their pardons was, quote, the essential contribution of the circus to the morale of the nation in the time of war. So the message was clear. The public entertainment of the traveling show was deemed more valuable to the country than the final justice owed to the victims of its own criminal negligence. Let that sink in.
But I can understand it, because really, what good does it do to put them in prison?
Yeah, but there's not other circuses?
At the time, no, honey.
And the circus can still go on.
But you understand what I'm saying? I'm trying to look at this logically.
Well, no,
I don't do very often.
Right. I get what you're saying, but it's like, why couldn't the circus still go on? These are circus officials. They're not the performer.
Hey, whatever happened to the flying Willingas? Or because they were up in the air when all this started.
They probably died too. But you know what I mean? They weren't performers. The circus still could have went on. Why pardon them? Just let them out. Why pardon them? Pardon them is saying, oh, it's fine. You didn't do nothing wrong. So in a final twist of irony, Haley, one of the officials, served only 8 months before being pardoned and would go on to be elected as U.S. Congressman for Florida, where a major public institution, the James A. Haley Veterans Hospital, is now named in his honor.
You've got to fucking be kidding me.
Nope.
Now that I don't agree with. Yep. Like that old saying, money talks and BS walks.
Yep. So now the Hartford Fire isn't a ghost story, but it still haunts all the same. It's proof that the worst monsters aren't always hiding in the dark. Sometimes they are the choices people make when profit matters more than safety, when convenience outweighs compassion. 80 years later, the field is green again. The laughter of children is back where it belongs. But every siren, every fire drill, every illuminated exit sign carries a trace of July 6, 1944. That is the legacy of Hartford. A warning written in smoke and memory. And that is the Hartford Circus Fire of 1944.
It's sad.
Yes.
No, your great-grandparents were only nine. It wasn't even nine. Well, Dad was.
Dang.
But Grandma was only eight.
Dang. But yeah, a lot came from that, though.
Yeah.
A lot of changes.
And
a lot of the safety regulations we have today.
And they're all things like and they're always changing and upgrading those regulations.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the nice part about it.
Yep. And the Hartford Circus Fire is the entire reason why. So although there were so many lives lost, mostly children, good did come from it in a way.
Yeah.
There were regulations.
I wish they still could have figured out who that baby was.
Needed. That should have been put in place to begin with.
You know that.
Maybe someday they will.
Yeah, with the technology with DNA nowadays.
I mean, they're retesting evidence from JonBenet Ramsey case. So maybe someday technology will be good enough. And they'll be able to figure out who she was. I don't know if that'll be in your lifetime, but who knows?
Hey, I'm not that old. I'm only 65. Come on, I got at least another good 20 years.
Okay. That's all we got for this one. But make sure you come back next week because the search for answers never stops. Next week, we are going to dive into a case that has mystified investigators for nearly 50 years. A vanishing act involving five people, a deserted car, and a discovery in the eerie silence of the California wilderness that makes absolutely no sense. That one, that's a good one. I wonder if you were in California at the time.
I don't know what year.
78.
Yeah, your mom was born the next year. I was 17. I was.
Oh, so you might know this one. If you were living in California at the time, you would have been 18.
I'd have been 17, depending on what time, you know, what part of the year it was.
You were 17. Because it happened in June.
Okay. Yeah, I was 17.
Yep. Maybe you know about this one. Watch to see.
Maybe.
All right. Well, come back next week to hear that one. You're an unsolved mystery. And before we go, remember to rate, review the show wherever you listen. You can find the links to our Facebook for those photos and our email address. To send your emails to in the description. And we'll see you next time for the haunting story of five men who went up a mountain and simply disappeared. Until then, have a great week. And remember to
watch out for monsters
and don't kill people. Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.